Session number 7175, reel 2.
So Alexander Stan, you're reel 2. Could you tell me a bit more about the artillery formation?
Well, it literally was, you started off as companies a long way behind the line, formed up, spread out over the area that a battalion would cover. Then a signal would be sent in some form, and the companies would spread out into four more sections, which would be the four platoons. And you could then break that up into four sections again.
So it was basically you would break down the whole battalion into a series of platoon or section blobs. Or roughly diamond shaped,
that's right, yeah,
to move forward. How far from the enemy would you try and put it into a line?
Very difficult to say. Entirely depends on the ground. If you were well hidden behind a fold in the ground, you could get very close up to the enemy before he could see you. And the last you want, you remained in artillery formation to the last possible minute. On the other hand, if it was open ground, you had to spread out fairly quickly into small things. Otherwise, one shell would knock the whole company out. Entirely dependent on the ground.
Roughly how far from an enemy position would you launch your final rush?
Oh, very close. We'd do it in section rushes. And then the last rush would literally be about no more than 100 yards.
By section rushes, do you mean that one section would be firing and the other section would be moving?
That's right.
So essentially it was like skirmishing on a grand scale.
Absolutely the same as what had been happening for years. There was no change, I don't think, in the drill from what they'd done in South Africa or Egypt in the 1890s.
And what was the role of the Lewis guns when you were doing such an attack?
Oh, well, they would give covering fire while the section one would give covering fire while the other one moved forward.
You said you were taught to actually charge with the bayonet. Was the idea of actually killing the enemy with the bayonet taken seriously?
I think it was. I only saw it once. I saw actual hand-to-hand fighting. Actually, the people, instead of bayoneting, people were practically hitting the Germans over the head with the butt of their rifles more. But they were fighting with their bayonets, yeah. But it was slogging in with anything you'd got.
So the idea was, to actually use the bayonet, not just to use it as a psychological weapon to frighten the life out of them.
No. Yes, it was, really, yes. And I tell you another thing that we used a lot was the entrenching tool handle. We carried an entrenching tool on our backside, a little spade and pick, and the handle of it hung down the side parallel to your bayonet scabbard. Well, you had that in your hand. It had a nasty iron ring at the top, and you could bash anybody on the head. I also found it very useful in the trench to sort of stop you from falling against the trench when I walked along. I used to have it in my hand to prop me up.
So you could use it as a sort of club?
Club, yeah.
When you were doing an attack, did you practice outflanking and enveloping movements, or was it always straightforward frontal attacks that you were practicing?
I'm afraid it was terribly frontal attacks. Not half enough was made of using the ground. I will tell you later of an attack on a village where I personally was successful because I was able to use the ground for the first time in my life.
Well, presumably these tactics with frontal attacks have been based upon 3 or 4 years' experience of having to face a continuous enemy line with no flanks actually available to turn.
Oh yes, and the holes in the wire and everything else, it made you, you had to go forward straight to go to where you knew the hole in the wire was. You had to go straight, otherwise you'd get entangled with everybody else.
Did you ever have any training with tanks or armoured cars?
No.
What about artillery support? Was that assumed? Or?
That was extremely good. We had, in the Guards Division, we were very, very close with our artillery, and the commanding officer of the field regiment that supported us became a terrific friend of the commanding officers. And so we always had very good officer relationship. And the gun officer, I always knew where he was and said I could get hold of him.
So you could always ensure that you got your support at the right time.
Yes, I think it was very, very good.
What about support from the air, the Royal Flying Corps? Did you have anything to do with them?
None at all. I mean, we saw an odd aeroplane, and we saw a lot of balloons being used for observation, and it amused us to see the Germans coming over and shooting them and the chap having to jump out.
So there was air activity over your sector?
Oh yes, you saw them, but not many. I mean, it's quite a rare sight to see an aeroplane.
If we can move on, I think that eventually you were sent to be a liaison officer to the Americans.
Yes. In July, after we'd had a short rest out of the line, we came back practically to the same trenches we'd been in May, and the Americans came up, started coming up to take over the line or to learn how we'd carried on. First of all, they sent an officer who came up and amused us because he told us all about how they fought on the plains of Texas and wasn't really very interested in fighting in a trench. He also drank all our whiskey, which was rather wasn't very popular. Anyhow, the next thing was that the battalion of the Americans came up, and the staff had not realized that their platoons were between 30 and 40 strong, and ours were down to about 12. Consequence was the trench was absolutely solid with men. You couldn't move up, down, or anything else. They all began talking. We also learned that they didn't have any centralized way of cooking, and every man was expected to cook for himself. And so our precious revetments that we'd spent weeks and months in making in the trenches, they began pulling down to make little fires to cook their food on. They also told us, asked us what kind of rations we had, and we said, oh, bully beef and bread and margarine. And he said, say, we have tinned turkey, tinned chickens, tinned salmon. Oh, we have fine food. I said, you're jolly lucky. And they went away. I remained at the company headquarters after a time. One of them came back and said, can we have some of your bully beef? And I said, why is that? They said, well, we just opened our tins of tinned turkey, tinned chicken, tinned salmon. They're all full of butter beans. So we taught them how to get their food done.
What sort of condition were they in when they went into the trenches?
They were in very good form. They didn't seem to realize that the Germans were close. They made the most appalling noise, which of course frightened the Germans, who thought they were going to be attacked, I think. They actually had a bet on as to who shot the first German in this battalion. And the Germans sent over a patrol to find out what was happening. And of course, they all let fly, and they did shoot the equivalent of a German company sergeant major, who was brought in dead. And of course, then there was the most appalling arguments: who'd shot him? Because about a million rounds had been fired. But they're very keen, and they, as I say, there were too many of them in a small space.
What sort of armament did they carry?
Same as us, very much. Excepting, again, they had a tent on their backs, which they used on the plains of Texas, which isn't much use in a trench. And they got in the way, but anyhow, they soon threw them away.
Who had they been fighting on the plains of Texas?
Oh, I think in the Civil War.
So still thinking back to that,
yeah,
that time.
Yeah.
And it sounds as though they didn't really have much idea of living or fighting from a trench.
No, very little.
Did they show signs of adapting to realities?
Very well. But I didn't actually see them in the, going into an attack in the First War. But they must have, because they did very well at Chateau Thierry and other battlefields further south.
How long were you actually with them?
Oh, only about 4 days.
Did they send out any patrols in that time?
Oh, yes.
And how did they do?
Well, not very well. And they caused the most frightful commotion. And the Germans kept on thinking they were being attacked. And I had a very uncomfortable time because we had much more shelling while they were there than we kept it all quiet.
This was just because they were noisy and there were a lot noisy of moving about.
Yes. See, we were very quiet because... And we also had to be very careful about talking, because the Germans had listening posts and they listened to everything, including your telephones. And we had sent quite a lot of messages in Welsh, so that the Germans couldn't understand it, because at that time the field telephone could be listened into. It was only later that we had a thing called a fuller phone, which you couldn't listen into.
So the Germans actually managed to get into a position to tap your phones.
Yeah, underneath you sometimes. I mean, some places up near Ypres, they got right underneath certain things. And so did we. We mined underneath. We blew up Hill 60, wasn't it? By mining underneath their trenches.
Messines,
that's right. Sorry.
Did you find the Americans were amenable to your advice?
Oh, yes. Highly amused. And very ready to learn. Yes. No ill feeling at all if you told them that it wasn't the way to do it.
So they were anxious to find out the correct way and to get on with it?
Yes. They started off by being very pleased with themselves, enthusiasm. And then when they learnt at the bitter end that, that there was a bullets and things came if you made a lot of noise, they went quiet and they began to learn. They learned quickly.
Presumably they hadn't been in France before.
Oh, they'd never been, no, no.
Did they come from a particular area of the United States?
Well, I've mentioned the plains of Texas because I think they came from Texas. I don't think they were fighting battles in Texas, but I think they said down on the plains of Texas. I think they came from Texas, the particular I was with, because I remember them talking about Texas.
Southerners, then? I think you also said that in August 1918 you did actually go over to the offensive.
Yep.
Was that from the same sector?
From the same sector, but in the first battle we were in reserve and we followed... it was the Guards Divisional Front. I mean, we followed the Grenadiers of the Coast Team, whoever it was in front. We were the reserve battalion in the first attack and weren't used. We came in on the second phase, the middle of August, at the Battle of St. Ledger.
Could you tell me what happened in that battle?
In the Battle of St. Ledger, we reached the high ground, looking down into a valley and some railway lines, I remember, and the Germans on the far side, and it got held up. We were told to capture some trenches and consolidate them, but when we got to the trench, we found they'd only started digging them at some time and never been completed, so that half of us were left out in the open because they were just traced out. Anyhow, we were told to halt and to attack later. And then came the message to attack, unfortunately, ending in confusion of timing.
Could you say a bit more about how the confusion arose?
Yes. Message came through saying you will attack as planned, and the time is as many lives as a cat's got. The chap said, yes, nine, I suppose, to himself. The person at the other end said, you understand what I mean? Four and a half brace. The chap said, yes, nine, I suppose. Didn't say nine on the telephone, of course. Whereupon, somehow, he said, of course, I'm talking double. Whereupon, the line went dud. A shell hit it, I mean. And the signaller gave this message. Well, then there was an argument amongst the company command, the two company commanders, as to whether it was 4:30, four and a half, or 9 o'clock, according to the lives of the cat. And we decided it was 4:30 because we usually attacked at dawn, despite the fact that 4:30 it was pitch dark. Anyhow, the commanding officer then started to come up to confirm this telephone message, but unfortunately was wounded on the way, and it took a long time for a message to come to take my company commander back to command the battalion. And so no further message came about the attack, and at 4:30 we attacked, and nobody else did. I'm talking about the Welsh Guards. And after a lot of confusion and thing, we had to withdraw back to our trenches, which we got back to at about 8 o'clock, whereupon we got a message to say, get ready at 8:30 for the attack, we'll go in at 9, when we became rather annoyed. But I suppose we carried out our orders and eventually captured the high ground.
So this was a battalion attack?
Divisions on our right and left were attacking at the same time.
But what's your whole battalion?
But we were the whole, well, yes, whole battalion was attacking. Three company was got it further forward on the first day, and Prince of Wales Company number two were behind them in the front line in a V like that, and I suppose number four was behind. I was in number two company.
So you had three companies
forward and one back, really.
And one back in reserve.
Yeah.
How far were you from your objective when you started the advance?
Oh, we advanced quite a long way. I should think at least a mile before we came up to it. Before we came to the interview of the Germans, yeah. They'd withdrawn. They must have withdrawn the night before or something. And
into the village?
Into a slope, yeah. It wasn't much of a village, it was more of a slope for a hill, and we looked down into this valley, and they were on the other side.
So what you had to do was go down the slope...
Down that, and then climb the hill the other side.
With the enemy... Yes. Presumably, the enemy had a good sight of you.
They did, but luckily at 4:30 in the morning, when it got light, whatever time it was, it was very misty, and you could see Germans running about, just like they could see us running about. But one minute they were there, and the next moment they were lost in the smoke of mist, more than shells.
What sort of formation did your companies adopt when they were advancing towards the enemy?
We went down the bank, spread out.
Did you go down
in sections?
In section blobs?
Blobs.
And what happened in your... premature attack, was it stopped, or were you recalled?
Stopped, oh, very much so. The Germans were pretty strong on the hillside on the other side. And I went down with my platoon, and they began shooting us up so much that I had to jump into a dugout, which was a German one, facing the wrong direction for me. I dived into it. I then found I couldn't get out of it because every time I put my head out, they were able to have a shot at me because they were looking straight at the hole. I was rather like a rabbit in a rabbit hole. I used to dangle my hat out on the end of my stick, making wasted ammunition.
So the was the means which the Germans used to stop you small arms fire, or did they have artillery and mortars or other?
Oh, both. They were very good with mortars, always have been. They were again in the Second War.
What about artillery? Did they bring any artillery?
Oh, yes. Rather, I don't know what... looked rather a small barrel, but I suppose the same as our 18-pounders, which we had then.
How far away from the Germans were you when you were stopped?
Oh, we right in amongst them. One moment they were there, and we were here. In fact, the commanding officer was got behind them in looking for us, coming to try the new commanding officer, the one having been wounded. My company commander, acting commanding officer, got cut off for about 2 hours behind the German lines.
So you did actually penetrate into their position before they stopped you?
Yeah.
It sounds as though it was very, very confused.
Quite very confused, especially with this early morning mist. I can see a German officer now in a greatcoat, running, a very long greatcoat that they wore. I can see him now running along.
What sort of positions were they in? Had they dug deep trenches and wired them in, or were they in temporary and improvised?
They were in temporary ones, and there was no wire that I remember. It was very smooth grass, as far as I can remember.
So they hadn't managed to dig in at all?
Oh, they dug in, yes, but only sort of what I call foxhole things, rather like we were at the top.
So it wasn't really an overnight resting place for them?
Yes, they'd withdrawn there. We'd driven them out the day before to see if they're proper trenches. And they were the rear guard holding us off while the main body was going back much further.
Would you have any idea at all about how many of them there were?
No. Intelligence was frightful. I never remember anybody ever telling me anything about the enemy.
When you made your second advance later in the morning, what happened then?
Oh, we overran them and captured the high ground, held it, and must have been relieved, because we'd had a pretty good bashing the day before. I mean, the company commander next to me, the commanding officer was wounded, the company commander next to me was killed. We'd had quite a number three company, Major Ellis, had a lot of casualties in the leading company.
What about your own platoon? Did they suffer a lot of casualties?
No, I was very lucky.
And why do you think the second attack succeeded where the first one had failed?
Oh, because the other people were attacking on the right and left. We weren't just the mugs going forward on our own. I mean, the Germans were under pressure. They couldn't bring their artillery or anything onto us because they'd got divisions either right and left. And other battalions, the Scots Guards were there, as well as us, in the front line.
So, would I be right in saying that in the first attack, you were getting a lot of fire coming in on you from the flanks, as well as from your direct front?
Yeah, everything fired at us. Oh, I thought so. Felt like it.
That sounds as though you were very, very lucky indeed to survive the first attack, let alone be able to push forward again for a second go.
Well, I think so too. If I hadn't left my platoon in a trench and myself jumping into this rabbit hole, I think we would have been. It was only that the Germans had to reorganize. They were just as confused as we were, that we were able to sort of reorganize ourselves.
How did the men react and behave under this fire, particularly under the disappointment of the first attack that had been beaten off? Did it depress them?
Not that I remember. In fact, they were marvellous. They were very different men to the Second War, who were also marvellous in their way. But these men had never been out of their villages at home, that were there no motor cars to take them away at the weekend. And so they were very much together as a group, and they'd back each other up the whole time. Nobody would ever let anybody else down, because it was Tom Jones from down the road. We can't let him down. Poor old Bill from up at the farm, we must go after him and get him back. No, though. But it was a much more community.
Do you think the fact they were miners also helped bind them together?
Oh, very much so. You'll see that in all their relationships, even in peace. And you go to the Welsh valleys, terrific fervour of the singing, and the whole thing is... They're very, very tough people. They live a tough life, so they're used to a tough time.
So they're accustomed to danger.
That's another thing.
Now, I think that shortly after that attack on St. Ledger, you managed to break through into open country.
Yep.
How did that happen?
After St. Ledger, we attacked the Canal du Nord, which was just below Cambrai and Bourron Wood. The Grenadiers had a... we reached the canal, then we halted, and great plans were made. We had to have ladders to go down into the cutting of the canal and then climb up the other side up ladders, because it was so steep. It was dry. It had not been completed. Bourron Wood was terrifically defended by the Germans, and the 1st Battalion of the Grenadiers were on our left, and we were on the right, and the Grenadiers we had a pacing, but nothing compared to what they had. And that's what I saw the village of Flesquières just on my left, where Lord Gort was winning his VC. I didn't see him win the VC, but he was winning it as I was miles across the country. You could see Flesquières, as the soldiers called it, on the left.
And that, of course, I think, was where the Germans had stopped the tanks getting...
We saw the German, the British tanks. There were some lying there from 1916, isn't it? December 1916, when they first Battle of Cambrai. And they tried to stop. It was the Hindenburg Line. It was their line that they were going to hold at all costs. But luckily, we were able to break through it. Because we, of course, got the reinforcements, and they were getting weaker while we were getting stronger with the Americans coming behind us.
Presumably, though, by the time you assaulted these positions on the Hindenburg Line, you'd had to absorb and integrate a lot of replacements and reserves into your...
Oh, yes. And while we were there, we lost two or three officers and on patrols. I mean, I remember a very nice officer being killed on a patrol. On a quiet day, I mean. And there was this terrific bombardment taking place before the attack for two or three days. And it was in August, and lovely summer's day. I'd been up all night, sort of thing, getting things ready. And thought, well, now I'll have a little peace and